Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, wherever you are on this gorgeous planet of ours. I am so pleased that you're able to join us because we have a subject that is, to the best of my knowledge, affecting so many people all over the world. And here in the United States, we're going to be focusing more on what goes on in the United States. But what is that? Well, it is about opioids. Also, alcohol. My guest today, Scott Stevens, he's an award-winning author. He has written a number of publications, and this one is entitled, Look What Dragged the Cat In. All right? Mm-hmm. We could rephrase that, but I will tell you what, the cover of this book, really, when you look at it, you just go, am I seeing what I'm seeing? Yes, you're seeing the head of a snake. Scott Stevens, welcome to the show.
Donna, it's an honor, and thank you very much for inviting me along. Glad we could connect.
Well, so am I, Scott. Now, you have quite a background. You have been to many different conferences, the 2000 International Conference of Addiction Therapy and Clinical Reports in Paris, in the same year, World Congress on Advances in Addiction, Science, and Medicine in London, the International Conference and Expo on Clinical Psychology in Amsterdam, and the International Conference on Dual Diagnosis and Disorders in Melbourne, Australia. Did you ever have a chance to get home?
Yeah, barely. I was pretty busy last summer, and I've got a couple of international academic conferences that I'm speaking at again this summer. But you know, it's all a good opportunity to present the work, the research, the books, and to talk with other professionals from other parts of the world to find out, you know, where our similarities lie when it comes to drug use in their countries versus or compared to our country. It's not really a comparison you want to make, but it's worthy to look at the condition of the human state of mind, the state of being, and how we can all improve our well-being.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very important. We are, if we're informed at all, aware about an opioid crisis. But I look at so many different points of history, just in the United States, and you are more specific. You talk about an American morphine crisis in the 1860s, cocaine in the 1890s, heroin in 1910, methamphetamine in the 1950s, heroin in the 70s, crack cocaine in the 80s. Then we went back to meth in the 2000 and cocaine again. And we've got the opioid crisis. This is something that throughout the history of humanity, you can go even into the history of China, mm-hmm. and they had a major challenge with the English bringing in narcotics into China. But China had mm-hmm. already had certain patterns, but it was being brought in with such abundance. It was a very lucrative trade, just like it is today. And it creates nothing but havoc. But you come from a bit of a different twist in that you ask how many, you were asked how many opioid deaths are alcohol related. Your answer was they all are. How can you make such a, broad statement about that, Scott?
Well, to back up a little bit, when I look at every single one of the crises that you just mentioned, they're all alcohol related in the essence that alcohol is our first drug. And part of the dialogue that's missing today is we talk about alcohol and drugs. Well, alcohol is a drug. We just we glorify it so much that we don't really call it what it is, in that it is a drug. And we look at the cultural relationship with drugs, or especially the drug alcohol, as it relates to each of these crises, well, you go back to the Civil War era when we had young soldiers out in the field. Well, it used to be when you got hit by a bullet, you took a shot of whiskey and bit the bullet, and you know, that was your treatment. But mm-hmm. then along came morphine to address battlefield injuries because people couldn't get where they wanted to get with alcohol. Fast forward to the 1920s, and alcohol was banned, so people couldn't get alcohol or get where they wanted to get with the alcohol that was available. So there we saw a resurgence of a different drug crisis. It, the same scenario plays through and through with every cycle of crises that we're in. And this one in particular with opiates, two-thirds of the illicit drug users in the United States point to alcohol as their first drug of use.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a straight line right there between the first drug they took and the drug if they overdose or if they're continuing to use it with a pattern of addiction, straight line to alcohol. And the other third of us, and basically the rest of us, Donna, where do we learn how to self-medicate? Mm-hmm. With alcohol. We self-prescribe. One beer didn't get us where we wanted to get. Still got a lot of stress from the day. How about a second beer or a sixth one? So we've learned to self-prescribe thanks to a lot of advertising and very, very slick advertising at that. We've groomed ourselves. We've groomed our kids to take drugs.
I think your positioning is a very interesting one. And I would say that a lot... When I look at any alcohol ads, and that is something that I have never had much of an interest in. I can remember being mm-hmm. told by more than one person, God, you're a cheap date. You don't drink. And of course, I was always on a diet, so you didn't eat much either. Uh-huh. But seriously.
Soda cracker and half a beer.
No beer. I couldn't stand beer. I don't like it. I just never did like it. I don't know why. But anyway, there are so many things that go on chemically in the body. And there are those people that can have a beer and that's it. You know, they're not going to do it. But there are those patternings, and I've seen it in families, where there literally is an intolerance for alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me how it is something that can be very pervasive. Now, my husband's family, his father was a hardcore alcoholic. I had a father, I learned later, that became an alcoholic later in life. I have no idea if he was an alcoholic early. He worked in the restaurant industry and the nightclub industry, and so consequently, that was something everybody did. Everybody drank. But mm-hmm. I don't ever, ever recall my father drinking during the day or anything like that. That was never anything that I saw. But I think he did later on because he ended up dying from alcoholism. But that was later in life he did that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you look at these things and you go, what's the trigger? Well, many of them start off with social environments, don't they?
They sure do, and we call it the social lubricant because what does this drug do? It's a mind-altering drug, and it's a central nervous system depressant, so it cools or relaxes you. It calms you down and makes you more comfortable. That is the purpose of a central nervous system depressant, is to bring down the nervous system, calm you, and you know that's the social connection right there. And we've now brought it into all of our celebrations and rituals. Before the program, you and I were talking about where I'm at. I'm in Wisconsin, and you know, this is the beer capital of the world, and we consume the most brandy per capita up here. So I mean, it's everywhere up here. As I've traveled around, it is part of culture, part of society, part of community, and part of right in our own homes in a lot of situations.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. And I'm not, you know, against wine or anything else, but frequently there are those patterns physiologically where people just cannot. Their body systems are just not going to work with it. And we have so many mm-hmm. people that have become addicted to opioids because of pain,
mm-hmm.
because of actual physical pain. And now that marijuana has been legalized in so many states, my goodness, the biggest purchasers of that substance is the senior citizens, and 90% of them, if I'm correct, they are taking it for the relief of pain.
Mm-hmm. The medical use of marijuana, it does have some medicinal properties. A lot of it has to be more researched, in my opinion. But you know, we're talking about alcohol or opioids or anything, any drug. The way I phrase it in all five of my books is that people don't take drugs to feel good. People take drugs to feel less bad. So in the case of pain, we're talking about relieving the pain. And there are a lot of people who are suffering chronic physical pain in this country that rely on opioids prescribed by a doctor and taken as prescribed to live a life day to day with a minimum of pain, or at least something to cut it down. The other factor here, Donna, is aside from the physical pain, there's emotional pain. And that's where a lot of people, you know, the physical pain may have a duration, may have an end line in sight. You know, say, for example, recovering from surgery. You know, a year from now, we hope you're feeling better. But with emotional pain, this stuff can go on because as a society, we don't talk about the things we don't talk about. We bottle it up inside. Traumas, histories, whether it's a childhood trauma or an adult trauma, and then we try to drink it under. We try to alleviate that pain, and we begin to self-prescribe. And that's the same with opioids. It's the same with alcohol. It's all related to pain. And, you know, people don't take drugs to feel good. They take drugs to feel less bad.
Now, that's a very interesting commentary. I want to share some of your statistics. And you talk about the current opioid crisis that we have, which has been spoken of. It really is quite serious. 50,000 plus people died from opioids, misuse of same. 2016 was the year that you have these numbers for.
Mm-hmm.
And you say by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the numbers were broken down. 20,000 were synthetic opioids, 16,000 were heroin, 14,000 were other opiates or semi-synthetic opiates, and the same year, 130,000 died from stroke, 87,000 died from Alzheimer, and 54,000 died from flu and pneumonia. Which is a crisis or an epidemic? Which one would you give that label to? And those are big numbers.
Those are crazy big numbers. Yeah, it surprised me in looking at the CDC numbers. We still have 30,000 plus people a year dying from the flu, which is 100% treatable. Addiction, of course, is 100% treatable, and it could also be 100% fatal. It just depends on the path you take. But we look at the opioid numbers at around 50,000, slightly more in 2017, because we're not winning this battle, this crisis that we're talking about, despite all the talk around it, all the legislation surrounding it. We're not winning. In fact, we're creating another crisis, and boy, that's a whole other program altogether. But we look at those numbers for opioids, and you're almost doubling it for the number of people who die from alcohol-related death. And that's not just cirrhosis. That's not just car wrecks. Alcohol is a leading cause of cancer. It is a leading cause of heart disease. It is 1 in 5 strokes is alcohol-related. We put those numbers together, and it makes this opioid number pale in comparison. And that's kind of what made me take the step up to combine my research from my other four books and do some additional research to look at what is the connection, is there one, to the current crisis. And more and more the evidence was glaringly pointed to, it's a straight line between what we've got going on with alcohol and our relationship to alcohol in this country and where we are today with the opioid crisis. And it is a tragedy. I'm not downplaying that at all. But boy, we've got another tragedy that we just turn a blind eye to.
Mm-hmm. I recall a very good friend of mine who had a brother who was addicted to substances. And he was in and out of rehab. And I'll never forget, and he would be by his brother. He would just do anything and everything to help his brother. And he poured thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars into the rehab scenario. And his brother would come out. His brother's feeling good. He's clean. Within maybe a month or so, he'd be back on something again. And I remember my friend Ed telling me, with the last rehab situation his brother was in, they started giving him some kind of substance. I don't recall what it was, to alleviate him. And he said, why are you giving a drug when you already know he's an addict? He's had this history. Why are you doing this? You are just getting him back out. Sure enough, his brother was out of that place within a month, and he was right back on the street. And it's really tough because there's a brain and chemical thing that has to be dealt with, and you don't hear about that.
There's definitely a role that the neurochemicals in the brain, serotonin and dopamine, play in the cycle of addiction, whether it's the initial starting out, the initial euphoria and trying to recapture that euphoria thanks to the dopamine release in the brain. But, get all the doctor speak aside from that, and, you look at, and this is where treatment begins to work, is when we look at what are they drinking under? What are they taking a drug to? What is making them feel bad to make them take that drug? And in a lot of cases, it all relates to trauma. And again, childhood trauma or adult trauma, it's all trauma. And the reasons why we take the drugs we need to address, rather than just the symptoms, treating an addiction with a Band-Aid just to say, hey, these 28 days are going to be great for you. We're going to make you stay sober while you're in here. We're going to give you the tools, and then boom, you're out the door on your own. Well, you go back to the same trauma in your head. You have the same people, places, and things that you went and frequented before you went into rehab, and you've got the cycle going right back in, getting right back into the cycle.
And it's really tough. There is, I'm trying to recall the country, I think it's Denmark, that has been taking a whole different approach. They are treating addictions as an illness, and they are finding that the shift that they have made has actually reduced the people going back in for treatment. And this I found very, very interesting, because it is just the opposite of what's promoted, especially here in the United States.
Especially here. The model you're talking about is Sweden, so you're one country away.
I beg your pardon. Thank you for correcting me.
Not a problem. But the Swedish model, it's been adopted in Denmark and in Portugal and in a bunch of other places where, aside from the decriminalization of certain drugs, when they look at an addiction as a health issue, you're addressing what is the reality of an addiction, and that your body has an illness rather than it's not just a mental illness or a mental deficiency. It is a physical illness that needs treatment. And, if you had a cancer diagnosis, you'd get treatment for it. Diabetes, you'd get treatment for it. And that is where the dialogue changes in those countries that have adopted the Swedish model, is that they treat this first and foremost as an illness, a medical condition, versus a shameful thing. They've taken the stigma completely away from the treatment world, and the results speak for themselves. It's great.
It really it was really quite informative. I came across this information, I think, about a month ago. But I am also very much aware of some research that I had come across, I think, a good 10 years ago, where people that had been very much engaged in the studying of alcoholism and various addiction problems, they said, when you have this kind of a chemical dependency, whatever that drug might be, it takes about 3, sometimes 4 years to get the body back into its proper harmony. And yes, that includes a nutritional supplementation, that includes having good food to eat, and there is actually a shift that occurs in the brain. And when you have that support with good nutrition, with good food, and the supplementations, the body has a tendency to heal much more quickly. But it takes that long for many of these substances to really be released, the chemical mm-hmm. properties they have to be released. Am I correct or not correct?
Yes, you're spot on with that. And if you look at the life cycle that a person has had with alcohol or any other drug, it usually lasted longer than 28 days, and we expect to fix that in 28 days in treatment. No, there's a very long tail end of it. I personally am an alcoholic in long-term recovery. I haven't touched a drop of alcohol since October 16, 2010, and I still consider myself in recovery because I know the disease that I have, and I know I'll be right back as bad off as I was if I don't take care of those things. Those first few years of sobriety are very essential to getting that body back on track from the years that you use a substance. And part of it is the neurochemical balance in your brain, and you're not going to fix that by taking a slow, easy ride. You're going to be serious about the nutrition that you put in your body and the sleep that you get.
Mm-hmm. There was someone that I knew for a number of years that was a hardcore alcoholic, and it wasn't until he was put in, he was having extreme, I guess you call them the DTs, and it was really bad. So the doctor gave him a dose of real strong reality. He said, "We have a rehab center here. You have a choice. You have to decide whether you want to live or die, because if you're not willing to go into rehab, you're going to be dead in 3 months." It's very simple. I don't have time to waste with you. If you want to live, let me know. Turned around, walked out on this guy. Nobody had ever talked to him like that before. And the physician was just a straight shooter. He dealt with this on a regular basis, and it had to be that individual's choice. And I will never forget that person. They were visiting my home, and they made the comment that they never would have believed, ever would have believed, the changes in their brain when they stopped the alcohol. They said, and this was a very intelligent, a genius in many ways. He was an architect. He was just a brilliant, brilliant individual. And he had been a hardcore alcoholic for a long, long time. And this, when he went through that process, he said his brain functioned differently. It absolutely functioned differently. But he substituted one addiction for another. He got involved with cigarettes, but that's okay. By the time he got out of it, there was so much damage done to the body because of the abuse of the alcohol. Mm-hmm. But the body does have a chance to heal itself if you're good to it.
It does.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that I point out in all five of my books, but especially in Look What Dragged the Cat In. I talk about the health consequences of even moderate drinking. We're told by the alcohol companies that we can drink responsibly, but the fact is that there's no responsible way to drink a toxin and known carcinogen. I'll interject right here and say I am absolutely against prohibition. That's not where I'm going with any of this. But if you look at what the clinical studies say that even moderate amounts of alcohol do to a body, it is a known human carcinogen linked to 8 different types of cancer, not just for a drinker who drinks the way I used to drink, but even for the moderate drinker. For women, it's the only dietary connection ever made to an increased risk of breast cancer, number 2 cause of oral cancer. So you just follow the path that it takes through your body, and it takes a toll on you. It's linked to heart disease. We heard that rumor sponsored by the wine industry, that red wine was good for your heart. Well, part of red wine is it comes from the skin of the grapes. Just eat the grapes. Don't ferment it, because alcohol is terrible for the heart. It weakens your muscles. It raids the body of B vitamins. So, you know, there are all these health consequences that you don't take into account, because we don't talk about those things in the news media and in the mainstream media in the United States, because we just love this drug, adore it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And but with the health consequences, they take their toll over time. A person who's chemically addicted to alcohol will shave at least 12 years off of their life. But even for a moderate drinker or a light drinker, what we call, you know, they're still reducing their life expectancy by 12 to 24 months. So it because this is a toxin, it's bad. No, I point out a lot in my presentations that if your liver had nerve endings, none of us would take a second drink, because it's that toxic.
Mm-hmm. I also appreciated the information regarding marijuana. Now, what we've got is a real serious situation with the legalization of marijuana. And I'll be honest, I was in favor of legalization of marijuana, so especially for people that need it medically. I mean, I've known so many people that have benefited from it. It is just amazing. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about really, I think, a lot of young people. And in the state mm-hmm. of Colorado, they're really having some major issues, because there's no regulation with the industry. Mm-hmm. And consequently, you honestly don't know what you're getting. You think you know, but you mm-hmm. don't know what you're getting. And they're having a real serious situation with teenagers. And you bring out the fact that the deposition of tar from the marijuana compared to cigarette smoking, it's four times higher. You see, mm-hmm. that it's all chemical. And this is something that I don't think people really understand. Anything that can alter your thinking, your mind presence, you have to be aware of the fact that you need to be responsible about this and realize it does affect you. And the younger a person is, and they've got enough research behind this really affects their brain.
Yeah, brain development goes on until you're 25. And you know, the earlier you start using alcohol or marijuana or any other drug, your body is still developing, whether it's your brain or any of your other tissues. And there are going to be long-term consequences. And you're right, the medical studies on marijuana use from teens to adulthood show long-term brain effects on teens who started young.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is what I'm with you 100% on medical use for marijuana. I believe we need to study this. If there's something in there that helps somebody, by God, bring it to market.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the recreational use of marijuana, we don't have our arms around the recreational use of our number one illicit drug, our number one killer drug, alcohol. Why do we want to legalize another one? Come mm-hmm. on. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I know that the police, and here in the state of Washington, we've had more than one scenario where the use of it has caused irresponsible, you know, actions and mm-hmm. behaviors. And this is something major that the law enforcement has to deal with. And this is not something you hear about in the media very much.
No.
You don't hear about someone that gets very, very violent or does something that's really screwball, but they're high on something or other. And then you've got these additions that are being added into heroin. Heroin at one time in history was so expensive. I mean, it mm-hmm. really was expensive. The drug dealers are smiling every time they sold some. And they still smile, but it's for a lot mm-hmm. less money. But they've got additives that they're putting in there which are deadly.
Yeah,
really,
fentanyl
really
is
horrible.
The crux of the opioid crisis today isn't the prescription pills. I mean, that's how a lot of people start. But when they can't afford them anymore, at a dollar a milligram, a single pill is going to cost you $40. well, you can't supply a habit for long on that. So people switch to heroin, street heroin, which is less predictable, less pure, and frequently is cut with inexpensive fentanyl, which comes from many parts of Asia, but the finger's pointing right at China on this, to make the heroin more powerful and less expensive.
This is not something to be taken lightly, and your book, Look What Dragged the Cat In, really brings so many points of documented information, and you bring out the point that in Europe, they have data centers which get in information on a consistent basis, where still here in the United States, we have things that are scattered all over the place, and we really don't have a lot of the accurate numbers. It's very difficult to be able to bring them together in a cohesive way, but the numbers have gone up. We have suicides, and this is something that in Colorado, because I've done some interviews on this, there have been more and more teen suicides because they've been imbibing with the marijuana, and some of the teens, before they've committed suicide, said, I can't take this anymore. They're so addicted that they have lost what we would consider reason, and who knows what else is affecting them. And this is not make-believe stuff. This is real fact. And I think sweeping it under the rug is not appropriate. And I agree with you. Prohibition isn't the answer. But I think educating and making people understand, or trying to make them understand, that this is something you really need to inform yourself about. And physicians, when they're treating people, they really want to help them get pain relief. But I think we are finding that many physicians are being, you know, being held accountable. And here in the state of Washington, they really have limited, because of what we've been experiencing here, they have really limited what can be given out. I mean, there have to be certain protocols followed, and physicians just are not able to give it out just because you don't feel good.
Right. And, you know, that's the thing about pain. A lot of times you can't identify it on an X-ray. It's very subjective. But there are people who are suffering legitimate chronic pain. And because of the steps we've taken to alleviate an opioid crisis, there are people who have chronic pain who can't get the pills that they need to function. And that's not functioning from an addict's point of view. That's limiting the suffering. And, you know, that's a pretty poor outcome of trying to clean up what the cat dragged in, and that's why I wrote Look What Dragged the Cat In instead.
There is so much good information in your book, Look What Dragged the Cat In. I think that this is good to be informed, and Scott, you obviously have achieved a great deal of recognition and I think appreciation from on the part of other people that say, yes, we are battling this ourselves. And it's not just in the U.S., it's in Europe, it's in Australia, it's on every continent just about, except when people are so poor that they can't get to it. This is what we're dealing with. It's how we make this into, like I said, an issue where we deal with it differently, and it can make a difference. Now, you have a website. It's Alcohologist. Okay, you can say it better than I can.
Yep, Alcohologist. Alcohol, O-G-I-S-T. Alcohologist.
There you go, alcoholologist.com. And that is something you can go and check it out if you've got a member of your family that is in a negative situation. Check out the information, because this is not a fabrication. This is real life with real people, and, well, we just need to be aware that this is something that has to be paid attention to, and our youth as well is being affected. Scott Stevens, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you for having me, Donna.
It is a joy. Scott Stevens, Look What Dragged the Cat In. Yeah, you could reverse the words, but you still got that cat coming in. What's the cat? Read the book. Find out more. And again, Scott Stevens, thank you for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo, and we are going to be taking a break here. When we come back, I've got more good things to share, but you know what? You can even give me a call if you so desire. 253-582-5597. I'll be right with you.
You're listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you'd like to have an opportunity to be featured on this program or Warriors for Peace heard Wednesdays, please send a copy of your publication along with your contact information to The Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review of the publication. Again, the mailing address is Post Office Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497.
Lakewood, Washington. That's right. That's what you do. Give me your information and we'll see if you can be a guest on the show. Now, I wanted to let you know who's coming on tomorrow. Tomorrow's a doubleheader. That's right. Every Wednesday we have Warriors for Peace first from 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific time. And then, of course, The Donna Sebo Show from 8 until 9. Tomorrow, we are going to be discussing on Warriors for Peace, Sarah Rickman's publication, Wasp Pilots. Do you know, I actually had the pleasure of knowing a woman by the name of Dorothy Olson. She's in her 90s now. When I knew her, she was in her 60s. Well, bless her spirit, she's one of the last remaining pilots. And from what I understood when I did the interview, she was a crackerjack at what she did. She flew all kinds of planes. Well, these were women that we need to honor and remember because they broke all kinds of paradigms. And then also, we're going to be talking on the Donna Sebo Show with Jane Battenberg. Change Within, Change the World. This is a very good publication, and it is significant because Jane shares some very, very significant stories and points of information. Now, we're going to be talking also about the Nepalese shamanic path. Every place in the world has ancient traditions and shamans, witch doctors, medicine men, medicine women. There were all kinds of titles that were given to these various talented people. And it's wonderful to be able to share the information with you. Wild World, I'm a Stranger to Myself, and so much more. Now, if you want to be kept up to date with everything, please, won't you go into my website, check out my calendar information. I actually have two websites. That's DelphiInternational.com, Delphi, just like the Oracle in Greece, DelphiInternational.com, and then MrsSebosClassics.com. And in MrsSebosClassics.com, you have my publications and, of course, my latest children's book, The Woodcutter and the Tree. The information is there as well. And if you want to order from my website, I will be happy to personalize that book for the child that you wish to gift it to. And we are working on the audiobook. We haven't quite finished that yet, but that's going to be forthcoming. So all of this information and more is available. And if you'd like to get my monthly newsletter, all you have to do is go to one of those websites, fill out the menu that's there, and then I'll make sure that that email newsletter that gives you my schedule, where I'm appearing, etc., right there. You have it at your fingertips. Now, I do want to let you know I have two appearances this week. Tomorrow, I'm going to be appearing at the Spectrum in Fife, Washington. I will be speaking at 6 in the evening, and I'll be arriving there probably around 5 o'clock. So I'll be available for many presentations, and I'll have my publications with me as well. Then on Saturday, I'm going to be, and the Spectrum is at the Poodle Dog Restaurant in Fife, Washington. The Cars appearance, the Cars restaurant, is on Bridgeport Way in Lakewood, Washington, and I'm going to be on the psychic panel, and I, along with a number of other people, will be doing demonstrations. So just know this is going to be one busy week. Yep, that's the way it goes. And I had someone ask me if I do private appointments. Yes, I do. And if you're interested in that, All you have to do is call my office at 253-582-5604 or email me. Go into my website and email me through my website, and I'll be happy to talk with you about fees and scheduling and all that kind of good stuff. All right, so what I wanted to do this evening, I really wanted to chat about women warriors. And this has to do with the Japanese culture. Now, I know so many of you have seen the fabulous Disney movie, Mulan. And it was just the other evening I happened to watch Mulan 2. And I thought, they just do such a marvelous job with their animation and with the storyline. And then I came across this information about samurai women. And the Japanese bushi, or samurai, are just, they have an incredible reputation. They were warriors and they were defenders, but the training they went through and the disciplines that they had to go through, well, do you know the women were actively involved? Yes, they were called the Onabugisha, and they were members of what was described as an elevated samurai class in feudal Japan. Now, young girls were started in their training when, you know, knee-high to a grasshopper. Why was this important? Because in those days of feudal Japan, sometimes the men were out fighting a war somewhere else, and women were needed to defend their own arena of involvement, whatever that might be. And they were trained in the use of specific weapons because when the man of the house was gone, it was their duty to protect the household, their family, and honor. If there was a war that was going to be engaging at all in the area, the women were meant to fight. So this is something that when I came across this information, I thought, wow, this is, my goodness, it's just not something that in the Western culture would have even been considered. Now, the women were taught to work with the samurai sword, and it's called a katana. And then they had other weapons that it's called the naginata. Now, I may be mispronouncing it because that is a Japanese term. But what's so interesting, if ever you've seen the long poles that have a semi-curved blade on the top, that's what a naginata was. It's a cross between a sword and a spear. And for women, it enabled them to move with extraordinary speed. They were able to manipulate it very, very well, and it was deadly. And because of the long pole situated, you know, associated with it, they didn't have to get real close to opponents when they were fighting. And the Japanese women typically were very small, but that doesn't mean that they weren't fierce fighters, because they were. And they were also a social status symbol among women. And they have all kinds of art. And their history is just absolutely amazing. And there was even an empress of Japan who was the first woman to be featured on a Japanese banknote. And there's so much controversy, apparently, and it was Empress Jingu, and she was she ever a fighter. Absolutely amazing woman. And they were not given the recognition that they should have been given, because they were just as fierce as the samurai that were out on the field. I mean, these women, you didn't want to mess around with. So if you are interested in any of this, I would suggest that you look up samurai women, because they were very powerful individuals. And women today are going in for many of the schools, and they start them young. And they practice it as a sport. as well as having different types of competitions. And there is a woman that is really very, very much recognized. Her name is Nakano Takiko. And she actually led a charge against imperial forces in the 1800s and the modern firearms. And by golly, they had guns. They didn't. She didn't. And she ended up being shot straight in the heart. And it was the end. That war was the Boshin War. It was the end of the age of the female warrior in Japan and the 1,000-year samurai era. Information is just amazing. Who would have ever imagined that there was this kind of a fierce force? You know, we hear about the Amazons. Yes, and the Spartan women. We've heard about that. But now you know in Japan, there were those women that were real fighters. And they were standing side by side, right along with the men. And they were highly respected. You wouldn't want to meet any one of them in a dark alley. Donna Sebo here. You know I'm big on recipes, but before I go and I give you a recipe, this one is for a beef pie. And it is a recipe that Annette Sim shared. And this is a woman that loved food, but she became incredibly obese. But these are recipes that she managed to work out. And this woman, I think, lost over 100 pounds, but they're foods that taste good. So I am going to share it with you, but I had to share this with you. There was a woman by the name of Sarah, and she's in Ontario, Canada. She said she worked in the front office of a housing complex that supports people living with mental illness. And there was this one day, oh, it was so hectic. Oh, my word. There was one thing after another, and one tenant, one of the patients, came in to pay her rent. Well, Sarah was just absolutely frazzled. The day had just been insane. And she turns to this person when they come in, and she says, "Have you ever had one of those days when you feel like everyone is out to get you?" The woman said, "Ah, yes, I take medication for that." I couldn't resist it. I had to share it with you. Oh, my goodness. Life is what it is, and we all have one of those days. Okay, let me give you this recipe, because if you're watching what you are eating and you're saying, "I'm so sick of carrot sticks, I really want something that's going to taste good," how about a beefsteak pie? Yes. Now, this is really easy, and I will tell you that Annette made this so simple. This is what she requires, and this is something that's so easy. You need 1.5 pounds of lean beef steak diced. Personally, I'd recommend a New York steak. I just think it's great. It's actually better than prime rib, my personal opinion. Now, you need a little bit of those at cooking spray. You need 1 cup of onion, and you want to make nice big chunks. 1.5 cups of water, 2 tablespoons of Worcestershire sauce, 1 tablespoon of granulated beef bouillon, and she likes to use the low sodium, whatever's your pleasure. Then 3 tablespoons of all-purpose flour, and then you need 7 sheets of phyllo pastry. Yes, that real thin stuff. Get it out of the freezer. Oh, for heaven's sakes, don't try to make it yourself. If you want a stress reliever, don't ever try to make phyllo dough on your own. It is not a stress reliever. It is a stress maker until you really get adept at it. All right, here we go. You're going to make the filling. You want to brown the beef in a nonstick saucepan that's been coated with cooking spray. Drain the liquid. Add your onions, stirring together for a good 3 minutes. I like to leak the liquid in, and as I'm cooking the onion, it sort of evaporates away, but it adds a little bit more flavor. That's Donna speaking there for that. You want to add 1.25 cups of water, and you want the remaining 1/4 cup set aside of water, so because you're going to blend it with the flour later. Now, by the way, if you just don't want to use the flour, you can use arrowroot. That'll work fine. But anyway, you want to add the Worcestershire sauce and the bouillon to the 1 1/4 cups of water, bring it to a boil, and reduce it to a simmer for 30 minutes with the lid on. You're going to stir it occasionally. Then take your flour, and that is only 3 tablespoons. You take your flour, blend it with the remaining water so that it doesn't have any lumps in it, stir it into the pan, and then boil it for 2 to 3 minutes until the sauce thickens. Now, once it thickens to the consistency that you would like, you take it off the stovetop and let it cool. Now, the pie is really easy to assemble. You're going to need a 9-inch pie dish, and spray that with your nonstick cooking spray. Cut the phyllo sheets in half. Use 8 sheets for the base and 6 for the top. Then you layer the pie dish with your 8 cut sheets in a rotating fashion, and you should spray with the cooking spray between each sheet. You know, normally you'd use butter if you were working with phyllo because you want to keep it moist. Then you spoon the meat mixture on top of the pastry, place the remaining phyllo sheets by laying over the top of the filling. Again, you work in a rotating fashion, spraying with cooking spray between sheets, then crinkle the edges together, spray the top of the cooking spray, and then bake it in a 400-degree preheated oven for 30 to 35 minutes until it's golden brown. And it needs to be served quickly after you fix it because the moisture from the filling will make the bottom crust a little soggy. But you know what? It will crisp again back in the oven or even under the grill. If you fix it and for some reason you're not able to put it on the table right away, leave it in the oven. Turn the oven off and just leave it there. Now, for those of you that love steak and kidney pie, you can replace 8 ounces of the beef with 8 ounces of kidney diced, which equals 1 pound of stewing beef and 1/2 pound of kidneys. You can do that too. You know, here in my store, I don't think I've ever seen kidneys out in the meat department. I think we'd have to ask for that because I just have never seen it. We're not big in this part of the country on kidneys, but I know that the English love the beef and kidney pies, and it's one of their favorite dishes. But I thought I would share that with you. That phyllo pastry is so wonderful to use for so many things. It really creates a whole different texture for a crust. So anyway, this is absolutely, I think, a dish that you could make that people would enjoy. And why not have something that tastes good? You need to make sure that you eat food that brings you a lot of satisfaction and also a sense of fulfillment so that you can feel good about the food you eat. I don't know why it is that we make food our enemy. Have you ever noticed that that is something that is typical? By golly, we've got enough diet books, I think, to wallpaper the White House with in this country and then some. Maybe about 14 White Houses. But we all need to find out what works best for us. I'm looking forward to the day when we are able to work with individualized DNA awareness about what works best for our bodies. I really think that that is huge. I was having a conversation with someone just this afternoon, and when I was talking with them, we got into a conversation about food. They're highly sensitive to wheat, so they have to avoid it. But they eat certain things, and I said, oh, I couldn't eat any of that. Oh, my goodness, that's just not going to work for me. And it was fascinating to find out what works for some people and what doesn't work for some people. And I think that that has a lot to do with what goes on with illness. If we don't know how to take care of ourselves, if we find that a certain food program doesn't work for us, we need to become more aware of our physiological chemistry so we can work in harmony with that. Some people can have sugar, no problem. Other people, they can't have sugar at all because it creates problems. Some people can eat a lot of vegetables, works great. Other people, no way. Same thing with meat or chicken. You know, we're all so different, and that's what we need to pay attention to. Okay, one of the points of information that crossed my desk that I thought might assist you is there is a new smart hearing aid that is being developed. And I think it's just incredible what we're coming up with because there are so many talented people that are well-trained, have imagination, creative, and they say, we can do something better. And this is across the board with everything. Well, there is in New York, the New York's Columbia University Foo Foundation School of Engineering and Applied Science. They have been working very diligently towards developing a high-tech hearing aid that can help people focus on a single voice in a noisy restaurant or any other setting that's packed with competing and overlapping sounds. This is something that when someone is losing their hearing, it is really a challenge because you're dealing with the signals that are going into the brain from the ear. And with many hearing aids, when there's noise, I know of one gentleman that has a hearing aid, he said the advantage of the hearing aid is you can turn it off. You don't hear the noise. He said, boy, is that a relief, because sometimes noise in places gets to be overwhelming, and I can understand why he does what he does. But if you don't know that he's got a hearing aid, you think he's ignoring you when you're trying to communicate with him. So that's not too good either. Now, this hearing aid that they're trying to develop works by monitoring your brain activity to determine whether or not you are conversing with a specific speaker. So this is a level of intelligence that's in this sophisticated hearing aid. And then this hearing aid will automatically pick that person's voice out of a mixed audio feed and amplify it. Now, that to me is just amazing. They found when they were doing a trial with this that almost all of the people that were engaged in this trial that had a hearing problem found the device was very helpful, and they wanted to take it home with them. They said, this is great. This is absolutely wonderful. You see, your ear automatically blocks out, and it has to do with the brain. You can be in an environment, and when you are having a conversation with someone, you literally will tone out or tune out what's going on around you, and you don't even think about it. But that's because your brain has adapted, and you've got this filtering system that is innate. So this is something that with hearing aids, you don't have. It actually creates an amplification. And I can recall a very dear friend of mine a number of years ago. He was losing his hearing. He was in his 70s. And he said that he hadn't had a hearing aid for so long that when he got one and he was using it, he was in a car going down a freeway. And in going down the freeway, all of these different noises that for so long he had not even been able to hear, he was hearing and they were amplifying. He had to take the hearing aid. It was so distressful to him. It disoriented him. So this is something that unless we have to use a hearing aid, we do not even think about it. But by golly, it is really something that is This will just be, this smart hearing aid will just be absolutely loved by so many people that need to wear a hearing aid. It's fascinating stuff. Also, something else medically, they are finding that tear samples from people that have Parkinson's disease have a higher level of a toxic form of a protein called alpha-synuclein than those from healthy individuals. And they say, because of this discovery, there may be one day a cure for Parkinson's. The human body is amazing. The various things that can go wrong, and yet at the same time, it has a phenomenal capability for healing itself, really is intriguing. And that is what makes, I think, medicine and the research of different things so vitally important. We need to remember that we should always have an aspect of curiosity. What is it that's at the core of a disease or an illness? What is that factor that creates it? That is one thing that in the American Western system, we often are prescribing drugs or assuming that something is going to work without really investigating the chemical ramifications. Well, we're constantly on that learning curve, aren't we? Donna Sebo here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever forget that. And don't give that up for anything or anyone that thinks that they know better than you do what is best for you. And that especially includes drugs. Donna Sebo here. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.